Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really major figure in American art, Frederick Edwin Church. And we're not just, you know, looking at pretty pictures. We're digging into the sources to see how this one guy in the 19th century basically made landscape painting into this huge national event.
Profitable, too.
Yeah, profitable and really theatrical. Our goal here is to pull out those key moments, the surprising bits from Church's life and work. We're focusing on how he managed this incredible balancing act.
Right, the blend between super detailed, almost obsessive scientific looking,
like exactly.
and these just huge, dramatic, panoramic scenes. So you'll get not just what he painted, but why it was such a big deal culturally, economically.
Yeah.
So Church, born 1826, Hartford, Connecticut. And he wasn't exactly a starving artist starting out.
No, definitely not. Came from money. His dad was a big deal silversmith banker.
Right.
And that gave Church, well, a serious leg up, the kind of access and support most artists back then could only dream of. And that early advantage was crucial. A family friend, Daniel Wadsworth, important name, he founded the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum. He basically set Church up.
Right. Set him up with a two-year mentorship starting in 1844. With the absolute giant of American landscape painting at the time, Thomas Cole.
The founder of the Hudson River School.
The founder himself.
Yeah.
And Church was Cole's first, and actually his only formal student.
Wow.
And Cole spotted the talent right away. Famously said Church had the finest eye for drawing in the world. High praise.
Incredible. But this is where it gets interesting, right? Because Cole is teaching him pure romanticism nature as spiritual sublime.
That's Cole's whole thing.
But Church, even then, he's sort of developing this other side, this really empirical, detailed approach.
That's the tension right there.
Yeah.
It really defines his early work. So he leaves Cole's studio in 46, sets up his own place in New York City, and boom, instant recognition almost.
Speaks volumes about his drive, like that painting, Hooker and Company Journeying Through the Wilderness from 1846.
Yes, that was such a smart piece. It took the grand landscape style.
Mm-hmm.
But grounded in something really specific, local history even. It showed Reverend Thomas Hooker, the founder of the Connecticut colony, leading his people.
Ah, so hitting that local pride note, Church was from Connecticut after all.
Exactly. Grand art, but tied to American history, morality. Big success. The Wadsworth Athenaeum bought it immediately.
So he's off to a flying start.
Absolutely. He became an associate of the National Academy of Design in 1848, then a full academician just a year later. I mean, that's incredibly fast.
Lightning speed. And still very much in Cole's shadow, at least initially, especially after Cole died so young in 1848.
Right. He paid tribute, paid it to the memory of Cole. You know, the classic romantic elements, lone tree, symbolic cross in the distance over the Catskills.
Yeah.
Beautiful painting. A real homage.
But then comes the shift, and it seems like it happened pretty quickly.
It really did. Church starts moving away from Cole's focus on, let's say, generalized spiritual meaning, and starts leaning into geological detail.
Right.
Scientific precision. You can almost pinpoint it with paintings like West Rock, New Haven from 1849.
Yeah. Compared to his earlier stuff, like Storm in the Mountains from 47, which is pure drama and feeling.
Right. Very sublime.
West Rock feels different. It's like you can count the strata in the rock face. It's so analytical. Why that change?
Well, it tapped into the spirit of the times, you know. America was young, ambitious, fascinated by exploration, by science. Geologists, naturalists, they were mapping the continent.
Cataloging everything.
Exactly. And Church seemed to feel that art needed to play a role in that. It needed to document the world, every rock, every cloud, with this kind of verifiable accuracy.
So merging romantic feeling with almost a modern scientific eye.
Precisely. And he really refines this with New England Scenery in 1851. Our sources call it his first true composite landscape.
Okay, composite landscape. What does that actually mean for someone looking at the painting?
It means it's essentially an invention, but it's built from reality. He'd take dozens of sketches he made out in the field, specific waterfalls, real mills, actual mountains.
Okay.
And then combine them all into one single, unified panoramic view, a scene that never actually existed in that specific arrangement.
Geographically impossible, but looks totally convincing.
That's the key. Topographically flawless, you could say. And patriotic, too.
How so?
Well, in New England Scenery, he includes details like a Conestoga wagon.
The symbol of westward expansion.
Right. For anyone seeing that in 1851, it wasn't just a wagon. It screamed progress, American destiny. So he's embedding this national narrative right into his beautiful, slightly imaginary New England scene.
Clever.
It's also around this time his work kind of brushes up against Luminism. We don't usually box him in as just a Luminist.
Right.
But he definitely used some of their tricks, that invisible brushwork, the really smooth surfaces, the focus on light and quiet atmosphere. It helped pull all those different detailed elements in his composites together, made them feel coherent.
Okay, so this blend of intense local detail and kind of invented grandeur, that was just the beginning, wasn't it? Because now things go global.
Yeah, this is where Church becomes the blockbuster artist, the American painter who goes out and sees the world.
And what kicked that off?
One name, really. Alexander von Humboldt, the Prussian naturalist. His book Cosmos was this massive cultural phenomenon.
I've heard of it. Huge influence.
Huge. And Humboldt basically threw down a challenge to artists. He said, look, art needs to engage with science. You need to go to the tropics, see the Andes, capture the sheer diversity of the new world, show how it's all interconnected.
And Church basically said, okay, challenge accepted.
Literally. He makes two big trips to South America, 1853, then again in 1857, Ecuador, Colombia.
Yeah.
Basically retracing Humboldt's own footsteps.
Wow.
And the paintings that come out of this, just spectacular. Think Cotopaxi, the volcano painting from 1855.
The active volcano, right?
Yeah, in Ecuador. And the geology is spot on, meticulous. But then he adds things, like palm trees way up high where they wouldn't actually grow.
Why do that?
Symbolism. It connects back to the idea of the Garden of Eden, bringing that spiritual layer back into the scientific view. It's that blend again.
And some scholars see even more in that fiery volcano, right? Like maybe reflecting the political heat back home.
Absolutely. The timing. Just a few years before the Civil War, that imagery of an eruption, of nature's power unleashed, it definitely resonated with people thinking about the tensions in the country.
Fascinating. What else came from that first trip?
The really big one was the Andes of Ecuador, also 1855. It was his largest painting yet. And it's this incredible synthesis. It shows different climate zones all in one view.
How does he do that?
You've got snow-capped peaks way in the distance, then dense tropical plants up close, even llamas grazing somewhere in the middle. It shouldn't work, but it does. Unified by this incredibly intense, almost heavenly-like.
Okay, the paintings themselves are amazing. But you mentioned spectacle. How he showed them was part of the story, too.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe just as important. He wasn't just selling art. He was selling an event. He turned the art exhibition into something.
Hmm.
Well, almost like a show. Think P.T. Barnum, but for landscape painting.
Was that controversial? Making art into a paid spectacle?
It was certainly new. Groundbreaking. When he unveiled Niagara in 1857.
A huge one.
Yeah, massive. Over 7 feet wide. He set it up in New York City, charged admission just to see that one painting. And it was designed to put you, the viewer, right there at the edge of the falls. Total immersion.
And people actually paid.
Tens of thousands. And get this, the sources say people brought opera glasses.
Opera glasses to look at a painting.
Yeah, to zoom in on the details, like the little floating log about to go over the edge or the texture of the mist. That tells you everything about what the audience wanted, that incredible precision.
So Niagara basically makes him the undisputed king of American landscape painting.
Pretty much overnight. And then just 2 years later, 1859, he drops the big one, the Heart of the Andes.
His masterpiece.
Arguably, yes. Even bigger. This huge panorama pulling together everything from his South American trips. Sources say you can identify over 100 different species of plants in it.
Wow. That's Humboldt's influence again, that scientific inventory.
Yeah, totally. But the presentation, pure theater.
What did he do?
He rented a space, darkened the room completely except for gas lights focused right on the painting. And the frame wasn't just a frame. It was built to look like an actual window.
So you felt like you were really looking out a window onto the Andes.
Exactly. Total immersion, maximum drama, and it worked financially too.
How well did it work?
It sold for $10,000.
$10,000, yeah. In 1859.
An unheard of. A record for a living American artist at the time. It was a signal landscape painting. This uniquely American genre had economically eclipsed the traditional big genres like history painting or portraiture.
Incredible. But he didn't stop there, did he? Always pushing.
Relentless. Same year, 1859, he pivots again. Heads north this time. An Arctic voyage, Newfoundland, Labrador.
From the tropics to the ice.
Right. And that leads to the icebergs in 1861, capturing that stark, frozen beauty. Another huge canvas.
And there's a story with that one, too, isn't there? About him changing it.
Yeah, it's a great anecdote. He exhibited the icebergs just as the Civil War was starting. The timing was terrible. The public was distracted, less enthusiastic.
Right, and critics complained.
Some did. They felt it was maybe too cold, too alien. It lacked a human story, a narrative element.
So what did Church do?
Here's the amazing part. He actually listened. Midway through the exhibition, he went back and painted in a broken ship's mast among the icebergs.
No way, added it later.
Added it later, a clear symbol of struggle, loss, human presence in that vast emptiness. It shows how even an artist at his level was still thinking about his audience, about the national mood, especially in wartime. He was responsive.
Wow. Okay, so let's move into his later life. There's personal tragedy alongside these travels.
Yes. He married Isabel Carnes in 1860. But sadly, in 1865, they lost their two young children, a boy and a girl, to diphtheria. Just
it
devastating.
It's imaginable.
And that terrible loss happened right before he embarked on his longest trip abroad.
The Grand Tour, 1867 to 1869. Where did they go?
All over. Europe, but significantly also the Middle East, Egypt, the Holy Land, Petra, Greece, Turkey, a whole different world from the Americas.
And did this change his art, moving away from those giant panoramas?
It seems so. We see him doing more intimate work, often with a really personal connection, like El Cazne, Petra from 1874, that famous temple carved into the rock.
Right, the treasury at Petra.
Exactly. He painted it as a gift for his wife, Isabel. It's framed really tightly by the canyon walls, the sick. It feels much more contained, more personal than Heart of the Andes.
And there's something else significant about that Petra painting, isn't there? Regarding his health.
Yes, it's thought to be one of the very last paintings he did entirely with his right hand. Around 1876, he started suffering from severe rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it became increasingly debilitating. And for an artist whose entire reputation was built on meticulous, almost microscopic detail.
That must have been devastating, making that kind of work physically impossible.
Exactly. And you see that physical limitation directly influencing his final big paintings. Take The Agency, around 1877.
What's different about that one?
It's what's called a capriccio. He's explicitly not aiming for strict reality anymore.
Like the composite landscapes from earlier.
Sort of, yeah. But even more fantastical. He's blending architectural ruins from all different places. He visited bits of Petra, temples from Baalbek and Lebanon, ruins from Athens, all together in one imagined poetic scene by the sea.
So less scientific documentation, more mood and memory.
Precisely. It's almost like after decades spent chasing that impossible scientific accuracy, his own body forced him back towards a more symbolic, idealized vision. Kind of like Cole's approach, in a way.
A full circle. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And while all this is happening, while his painting ability is changing, he's pouring energy into another massive artistic project back home. Alana. His house. Starting around 1870, he designs this incredible Persian-inspired villa overlooking the Hudson River, with stunning views of the Catskills.
And it wasn't just designing the house, right?
No, no. Olana was the total artwork. The architecture, yes,
yeah.
But also the landscaping. He spent years shaping the hills, planting trees, creating paths, framing specific views from the windows.
He saw the whole estate as a kind of living painting.
He basically did. He even wrote something like, I can make more and better landscapes this way than by tampering with canvas and paint in the studio.
Wow. So he's composing with nature itself.
Using the Hudson Valley as his canvas, viewed from his Persian palace, is an incredible statement.
A powerful image. But despite Olana, his fame as a painter, it didn't last into his old age.
Sadly, no. Tastes changed. Impressionism, modernism were coming in. By the time Church died in 1900, his highly detailed panoramic style felt, well, old-fashioned to many. The sources say he was largely forgotten.
Hard to believe after being the biggest name in American art.
Art history cycles are brutal sometimes. But the story doesn't end there. There's another twist.
To rediscovery.
Exactly. His reputation came roaring back later in the 20th century. The big catalyst was the icebergs.
What happened with it?
It had kind of disappeared. Ended up in a collection in England. Then in 1979, it came up for auction. And it sold for $2.5 million.
Whoa. Record-breaking at the time.
Absolutely record-breaking for an American painting then. Suddenly, everyone was talking about Church again. It signaled that maybe his work wasn't just a historical relic.
And that auction was followed by a major museum show.
Yes. The very next year, 1980, the National Gallery in D.C. put on a landmark exhibition called American Light, The Luminous Movement. And Church was right at the center of that reevaluation.
So that cemented his place again.
It really did. He became seen again as this key figure, the quintessential 19th century American artist who could translate the nation's ambitions about science, exploration, manifest destiny into these incredibly detailed, grand, and importantly, very marketable artworks.
So at the end of the day, Church really captured his era's spirit, didn't he? That mix of scientific curiosity and national expansion, all put onto canvas.
Beautifully put. He found a way to make science and spectacle merge into something uniquely American.
But there's still that lingering question, that criticism some people had even back then. Did his obsession with detail, getting every leaf and rock just right, did it sometimes get in the way?
Yeah, the criticism was that it could compromise the overall feeling, the poetic unity of the work, that maybe too much information distracts from the emotional punch.
Which leaves us with something for you, the listener, to think about. When you look at this kind of monumental art, art that's trying to capture something huge and sublime, where's the line?
Right. How much detailed scientific accuracy, the kind Humboldt or the critic Ruskin champion, do you need? And when does that meticulousness maybe overwhelm the pure artistic vision, the thing that hits you emotionally?
Is every single detail essential? Or can it sometimes be? Well, just too much. Something to consider next time you see one of Church's spectacular paintings.